nightmares, letters of rejection. Sorry, got a date tonight. Sorry, gotta wash my hair. Wish I could, but I can't. You're just a white boy, living in your white world, living in your white house. Go home and go to sleep. Start again tomorrow. Cry in the shower, cry in the pillow. When will this ever end? You often ask yourself, how long must I endure? All the smiles on my heartache. When the suburban white girls are getting you down. Just put on another hip-hop record. When your suburban white world is getting you down. Fantasy, sipping on a 40, wearing hooded sweatshirts, wearing those big boots, stopping on down the street. People know to stay away, cause you're the baddest. Mess with you and they'll get shot. Stumble through an alley, into a clearing, a great big field of grass, something up against the wall. All those little white girls that ever tried to hurt you, gagged and blindfolded, line them up and pull the trigger. When the suburban white girls are getting you down. Just put on another hip-hop record. When your suburban white world is getting you down. Turn the dial to the hip-hop radio.
CITR 101.9 on your FM dial. This is the Inkstead's radio show, the radio show where we talk about comics. I am joined by my co-host, Colin Upton. And today's special guest is David Heatley. That was the music of David we were just listening to. And I will bring David on the line. Have we got you there, David?
Yes, hello.
Awesome. How are you doing today?
Really good.
Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And this a lovely fall day. I don't know what it's like there in New York, but Vancouver, it's rainy.
Oh.
It's a typical beautiful day here.
It's kind of springy and nice here, like 75 degrees or something.
I was in New York in October last year, and it was astonishingly nice for 2 days, and then the third day I was there was quite the opposite and drenched in... Seeing all the people going out selling umbrellas, I've never seen that before. People just wander out into the streets, you know, big stacks of umbrellas selling. So.
Yeah, umbrellas are kind of disposable here in New York. It's bizarre.
So, I guess I'll do a quick intro of who you are, just for listeners that are listening. Deadpan is your main output of stuff, I guess, as well as you have work in the MOM anthology. Overpeck, that's the name of your ongoing serial, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And as well, you have a piece in the upcoming, or not the piece, but you did, you're doing the cover for the upcoming Houghton Mifflin Best American Comics 2006 anthology, which is edited by Mr. Chris Ware.
Yeah.
And a good poll quote for you is we interviewed Ivan Brunetti last year and talking about how honest his work is, but he said you're the most honest autobiographical cartoonist.
It's a dubious honor, but I'll take it.
Coming from Ivan, it's you know.
It's great. I really admire Ivan, so it does mean a lot to me.
So I guess we'll start out with your start in comics. Deadpan 1 and 2. Now, Deadpan number 1 is I guess primarily it's all Dream Comics, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all dreams. You know, I did some mini comics before that and, you know, tried my hand at an autobiographical story and then tried my hand at, like, thinly veiled fiction and then tried my hand at you know, really out there fiction, and none of them seemed to work. And then I realized that my favorite comics are really grounded in good writing, and that's kind of the architecture of good comics. And I realized that, you know, I wasn't much of a writer. I hadn't done a lot of writing except in my journals. And so I was looking over my journals. I had kept a journal probably for already, 10 years almost by the time I started comics. And I had all these dreams written down, and I realized they were pretty out there, pretty fully formed bits of narrative, and, you know, all I had to do was just illustrate them because they were already written. So that's kind of how I started with Deadpan. And, that's sort of, they say, write what you know. So that was kind of something I knew. I knew these dreams. I knew I'd been recording them. And, that was kind of the start of it.
So how far back do the dreams that you refer to in Deadpan go? Because you're saying you're doing it for about 10 years.
Yeah, I guess the earliest dream that's going to be in my collection book is from 1996. But I guess I meant my journals go back to, like, you know, ninth grade in high school when I was 15. So there's not dreams recorded from that time, but I just have pretty extensive... I've been cataloging my life for that long, I guess I should say, you know.
When you started recording your dreams, was that something you kind of done on your own accord, or was it something you'd seen in writers that you've liked who were pretty thorough about collecting their dream works? Because I know Burroughs was very... into recording his dream work. I think the Book of Cats.
Okay.
Can't remember the name of his dream book, but like that's something where.
No, it wasn't out of any like literary aspirations. Actually, it was probably more coming from like a pop psychology point of view. Like, you know, this is a way of getting to know yourself better or understand yourself. So, like, you know, I was like writing down all my histrionic teenager feelings, and along with that. You know, it was all the weird dreams I was having. And that is something, you know, as an artist, you need to, like, kind of quickly learn your strengths. And that definitely, I feel like, is one of my strengths, is I just have these spectacularly bizarre and vivid dreams. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people do. I mean, at least, I don't know, from what I've seen in comics and other art forms, I feel like mine are pretty freaking out there. So... I felt like I needed to go with that as a strength, you know.
A lot of people don't remember their dreams all that well. Was that something you had to learn to do, to remember your dreams?
Yeah. Well, they say if you write them down, you actually have better recall. And I've noticed that, like, there's periods where I don't write them down at all, and I don't remember them, and... If I just write down one, like, suddenly the next night I'll remember, and they even get more and more vivid as you go. So I don't think it's, like, a skill I learned, but it is something that gets sharpened the more you write them down. Yeah.
Do you use drawing as part of the process for remembering the dreams? Like, is it just descriptions? Do you kind of, like, have, like, ideas of the way things looked as far as, like, maybe sketching stuff out?
In the journal, sometimes it'll be, like, a lot easier to just do a little thumbnail drawing of what the room was like or something. But mostly the journals are just strictly text. It's not until, you know, I turn them into comics that I start drawing for the most part. There might be a little diagram here or there, but, it's funny. It's like the way I write them down is it's almost as neutral as possible. I'm just, you know, recording it like a detective or something. Just the descriptions. I'm not using any flowery language. I'm just writing it out. And then later when I decide that one is worth turning into a comic, I wind up treating the text that I wrote as, like, you know, the law. Like, I can't touch it, and it's verbatim. And, you know, if I wrote the dialogue, it was sort of like this, and then I write a sentence, that's the way it has to stay. I don't really mess with it if it's how I wrote it down in the journal. So, I don't know. I don't know why these things are like that, but that's become a process that I kind of stick to now. It's like the little rules that you trick yourself into following, you know.
Do you think you've learned a lot about yourself by doing this?
I've definitely learned about myself in general. It's funny because, I mean, I'm very interested in, psychology. I'm very interested in kind of working on myself and becoming a better person. And, you know, I have two kids now, so that's a big part of it. But in some ways, the dreams, like, I don't really want to know too much about what they're about. Like, I like them to have a certain amount of mystery. And so if there's one that's just kind of like an enigma or a puzzle to me and it's just really sticking in my gut, I'll say that's the one to do. But I don't really want to puzzle over it and understand it. You know, I could do a surface, like, analysis of it, but it's more interesting to me if I preserve that mystery for myself as I'm drawing it, too, so someone else might share what it might have felt like to have that dream. Because if I'm just explaining it, and if I understand it perfectly, I'm just explaining it, it becomes kind of dead. And I'm really mostly interested in someone having the experience, you know, the emotional experience of what I went through, rather than sort of the analytical or the cerebral version of it, you know.
It's more of like a surreal, primal, I guess, cartooning.
Yeah, well, it's just, I'd call it like experiential instead of anecdotal. You know, it's not, I'm not just telling you a good weird story, like, you know, look at this crazy thing I dreamt. Isn't that stupid? You know, I'm really trying to get someone to feel what that world must have felt like. Yeah.
Now, going through your work, like the first deadpan and the stuff in Moam, it seems like there's an intertwining between the dream stories. Is that something you find where you have like ongoing themes in your dreams?
Yeah, I definitely have recurring sexual dreams and recurring running from the police dreams. I had probably like 6 or 7 of those in my life. And I mean, in terms of, I guess you're referring to Overpeck in Moam.
Yeah.
I mean, that story is basically my attempt. I'm going to make it into a graphic novel of taking all the characters of my dreams from a certain period of my life and just treating them as fictional characters and putting them in a town and kind of seeing what happens when I let them interact. And again, that was like, that was a suggestion from another cartoonist, actually Kaz is his name, and I was saying, you know, I don't really know how to do fiction. I've just been doing this autobiographical stuff, and he had seen Deadpan 1, and he said, what do you mean? You have all these characters. You already dreamt them. They're already done. You've already drawn them. Like, just put them on a page and start writing underneath them, like, who are they? What are they? What are their names? Like, what's their backstory? And as soon as I did it, I found that I knew all the answers to it. Like, I knew exactly who this person was, and they're kind of like this person in my life and kind of like that person, and, you know, they grew up here. And so Overpeck is pretty much that. It's just taking the characters as raw material and then fashioning a story around it.
Yeah, and that's what I observed, is just there's, like, little parts that are here and there, but it's, I guess, a cohesive narrative. Now, you've got three parts in Moam. Now, they keep saying in all the Moams that it's going to be concluded. Is it going to be concluded?
Yeah.
Is it going to be concluded?
Question. This is controversial, I guess. we can break the story here on your radio show. I recently signed to Pantheon to do my collection with them, and that's going to be all my autobiographical stuff. But I also signed with them to do Overpeck, and so I'm actually not going to serialize it anymore. I'm just going to put it out as a complete graphic novel. And I will give, I'm going to give some kind of like one-page description of why in Moam, like what happened and what's going to go on. I don't want to leave people hanging, but yeah, in fact, it's probably going to change quite a bit from what's been run already. I'm going to rethink of it as a whole book rather than as parts, but yeah.
Well, mazel tov.
Yeah, thank you.
Book contracts are always a good thing to have for the cartoonist lifestyle.
Yeah, it's good to get paid for your art, you know.
And speaking of paid for your art, you're also a graphic designer, but you utilize your cartooning, am I right, within your graphic design work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd say I'm mostly an illustrator. I've done graphic design work, you know, as my jobs for, I don't know, I guess 7 years now, 8 years. But it's always just been sort of a day job. What I've learned there, I've actually put more into my comics rather than the other way around. Like, I've just learned what good, clean design looks like, and I've learned just about the hierarchy of information and about, you know, using symbols and just all those kinds of typography, all those kinds of things I've kind of put over into my comics toolbox. And I guess at my last job as an art director, I did try and do a few comics projects, and, you know, none of them went anywhere. That was a kind of an embittering experience, because I was always trying to, like, push these two worlds together. Oh, I could do a comics campaign for this, you know, this ad that we're working on, and it always got, like, almost the last round, and then it got killed for some reason. I just decided, you know what, let me just keep these two separate. They're not meant to be together, so.
The worlds will collide.
Yeah.
Now, was art school, you went to art school, right? I seem to remember from the autobio stuff. Was that pretty seminal in kind of developing your idea of kind of taking, of where you want to take your art?
Yeah, I loved art school. I mean, I know Dan Klaus is really down on it, but I just thought it was fantastic. And I went to San Francisco Art Institute, and I studied experimental film and drawing. And, you know, I didn't do comics in school, but it just absolutely changed my life, being there, being with the teachers, just having the freedom to create all day long. I mean, and just to be taken seriously for what I was thinking about. And definitely my conception of what art was radically changed before and after. Yeah, I just learned. I mean, I saw just a million films that I would never see otherwise, these kind of weird, quirky, one-person film projects, very personal, a lot of times autobiographical. So that's actually a pretty direct influence on, like, the kind of comics I do is from the kind of films I watch there. And, yeah, I guess I developed sort of an aesthetic sense. I just didn't really have one before. It was very crude and very primitive before, and I studied all these great people. And I should say, while in art school, I worked in my first design shop and probably learned as much there as I did in school because, you know, like I said, at the time I hated computers, I hated ads, I thought everything was corporate BS, and I didn't want anything to do with it, and it really, my boss really kind of spun my head around. He showed me, like, old logos from the 50s, and I would, like, copy those in my sketchbook, and he showed me, like, the constructivist posters, and he opened this whole kind of world of design up to me that I never really knew about, and, you know, and most of the time I find myself in bookstores just gravitating to, like, the design sections and graphic arts more than fine art. So that was pretty seminal, too.
I think Michelle Rebecliotti, the Paul series guy from Drawn Quarterly, he went through something pretty similar, where with his art schooling it was, like, this kind of archaic graphic design stuff where they're using, like, totally, like, stuff that's never going to be used again, but it was just more an idea of, like, getting the tools and the kind of that different look of, like that kind of older, you know, like you're saying, like the 50s logos and stuff, where there's a lot more, like, kind of design in there, and you can tell it's just a little more heart in there than more recent design work.
Yeah, I think probably it had to do with, by the way, I love his stuff. I think he's fantastic.
Oh, no arguments there.
Yeah. I think it had to do with, like, the place of comics in the culture at large. You know, it was still, even in the 50s, it still had a foothold. Like, most of the illustration in magazines, most of the magazine ads were still illustrated, first of all, which they're not so much today. But yeah, everything had a real cartoony, modernist cartoony approach. So, yeah, it's a lot of stuff to study there.
Was there an option to take comic cartooning courses at your art school?
No, there wasn't. I mean, it was sort of still this secret thing that only a few people knew about, that there were these amazing things being done in comics. It was, I remember bringing in a comics project I was working on to my drawing teacher, and he was really excited about my drawing. He said, "Now you just got to figure out how to sell these drawings, and, you know, you're really good." And I brought this, so this is what I really want to do. And he was like, "Oh, don't waste your time with that." Like, that's, don't. And I mean, in some ways, he was right. It was really garbage what I was working on at the time, but he didn't really know the world that I was aspiring to. And had he known it, he might have taken it more seriously. There was, like, a lot of great activity going on at the time. So,
how old are you, if you don't mind me asking, so we can kind of get an idea of the time frame of when?
No problem. Yeah, I'm 33 next month.
Okay.
So 32 now.
Now, going into art school, I know we're kind of continuing on the whole school thing, but I'm kind of see it interesting because a lot of cartoonists go into art school going, I'm going as a cartoonist going to art school.
Yeah.
And I could kind of see that being kind of a wall of involvement and stuff because you kind of put yourself into this clique almost of obscurity.
Well, That's what I went into art school, but...
And how long did you last, Colin?
But I took design, because there wasn't... Similarly to Dave, I took design because there wasn't anything for cartoonists, but you did learn a lot of useful stuff in design.
But I'm just wondering if, like, going in from a different aspect of just going to art school and kind of, you know, kind of going and checking out the different stuff, does it kind of give you a different outlook and a different experience of what you're going in there with?
Yeah, in retrospect, I'm really, really glad I studied film and experimental film, not even just Hollywood film or anything, just because it did help to break down, you know, I mean, I watched so much TV as a kid. I had so much, like, TV narrative junk in my head. It's like, it's sort of like debris that'll just be floating in my head for the rest of my life, you know, and seeing these films kind of helped to erase some of that, just having this different approach to, you know, putting a square around something and framing things and just a more personal vision for what moving imagery looked like. It really helped to change my idea of narrative. And I don't know, I mostly, you know, I don't want to, like, insult students of comics out there, but mostly the people I'm most interested in are kind of self-taught as cartoonists. It's like this weird, almost outsider way of making art. You know, you cobble together this quirky style by copying, like, you know, 10 different people into your sketchbook and kind of melding them together. And I like awkward drawing. I like stuff that's not really polished. And
what's some stuff you've enjoyed? If you
current people,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love Ron Rigi. I love, you know, Chris Forgies and the Ford Thunder people, Matt Brinkman and
Brian Chippendale.
Brian Chippendale, yeah. He's probably less my favorite than the others, but I do like his stuff a lot. Leif Goldberg, I just think, is brilliant. And
so a lot of, like, the Kramer type stuff.
Yeah, I feel like they're my peers, my contemporaries. but I'm very into what other people are doing. But I like everything. I mean, I like the more literary stuff. I love Kevin Izanga's stuff. And, you know, of course, for me, like, just the two greatest cartoonists are Chris Ware and Dan Clowes. I just never tire of studying and restudying their stuff. And, you know, I've probably learned the most from both of them. And I should say Gary Panner, too. I mean, he's probably... just as important as those two in my, you know, my little pantheon of greats. No pun intended there. I didn't realize I was saying the name of my publisher.
And they're all published by Pantheon.
Yeah, it's funny.
Is Panther? I don't know.
It's kind of embarrassing.
No, he's not actually, but...
Panther? Well, his original collection was, but
I think
anyway.
Panther was published by Pantheon.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm wrong. Well, all of them kind of, like, Panther's... I find him as interesting as a creator because he's not. I really don't see him as part of the comics continuum in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's really bringing, like, an artist approach to it. So, like, you know, I think of comics as, like I said, almost a graphic arts medium where it's you're kind of grinding these drawings through a design filter to make them readable and iconic. And Gary's really bringing, like, mark making and expressive line work, but he's doing it in a way that's he's not doing it like the way kind of European cartoonists do it, where it looks like Cézanne and it's very painterly and, like, poetic and, you know, almost pseudo-poetic. He's really, it's got this rawness and this, you know, childlike, gut-level, expressive.
The thing that always stands out with me with Panther's work is, like, you look at, like, his Jimbo stuff, and it's not, I'm drawing a figure of a guy. Here's a bunch of spots I've put here, swatches of ink, and it's a picture of a guy.
Yeah.
It's like two different ways, I think, of doing it. And
yeah, he really rides that line. It, you know, the illusion almost falls apart, but it just barely stays together, and that's what's most interesting about his stuff, I think. Yeah.
I'm thinking a quick song break.
Okay.
And then we'll jump into your autobio stuff. I have the tracks you recommended, and I also, just so you know, I found in our library here, at CITR, Velvet Cactus Society.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
So just so you know, it's there if you want us to play any tracks.
That's pretty awesome, yeah.
So what would you like to hear?
I don't know. You guys pick something. Yeah, off of that album, you mean?
No, well, off the... Well, let's say the stuff you requested from your current output of work.
Okay, you could play Well, I guess one of them has curses in it, doesn't it?
We're in Canada, don't worry.
Oh, okay.
It's college radio.
Listener discretion be advised. There we go.
You could play I Hated Your Movie. That's a recent song I wrote.
There we go. On the talk of movies and art school and stuff. We'll be back in a sec with David Healy and more discussion of comics and other good stuff.
Myself with a spoon. I hated your movie. I hated your movie. I hated your movie. I hated your movie. Got a lot of fucking up to call that cinema. Stupid cliche goodbye at the airport. No sense of how to light a scene or where to point a camera. Made me want to gag myself with a fork. I hated your movie. I hated your movie. I hated your movie. I hated your movie.
Inkstud CITR 101.9 FM. That was a goodie but a quickie. And we're back with Mr. David Healy, and we're discussing his comics, and that was one of your songs.
Yep.
That, and you're saying that's one of your more recent stuff, and you've been recording for many a year, I guess.
Yeah, since I was a teenager, on and off. Yeah.
You're a man of many passions.
That's for sure. Keep myself busy.
Now, I'm going to just continue the discussion we're having about comics, and I want to go into your autobio stuff.
Yeah.
And the honesty of it, and I'm curious, like, how important is that to you as a part of it? Because, like, talk about Ivan saying that's honest, and this is the guy that did like a 4-page diatribe about, I don't even get into it here, I don't think I have time.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely, yeah, it's definitely sort of the driving engine of my work to be as honest as I possibly can be. I had a writing teacher at art school who, he would always ask, you know, what are you risking? What are you risking in this story? Because if you're not risking anything, then what's the point of someone reading it? You know, you've got to really be putting something on the line and getting vulnerable, and that's kind of what I think makes good work. So I definitely try my best. I'm really not interested in, like, shocking people. I don't want to do it for the shock value, and I don't want to be in your face or anything. I try and do it in a way that's, you know, considerate in some ways. But I do want to, if I start writing a story, you know, like the sex history story, and I come across a detail and I say, ugh, that really, like, makes my stomach clench, I just say, you know, I got to include it for that reason because, you know, I don't want to shy away from it. That would be the cowardly thing to do. So, yeah, that's kind of my internal gauge when it comes to what I put in there.
When we had, I hate doing this named our thing, but when Chester Brown was on, mm-hmm. one thing he said that was important to him with the autobio thing was doing stories that kind of need to be told that, you know, people won't talk about. So, like, with the Playboy and I Never Liked You, it's like that's a part he wanted to share that, you know, isn't really discussed, but everyone goes through. Is that something, like, especially with the sexual history stuff where it's just like it's so frank and honest, but it's just like, you know, put it there for people to kind of know that other people going through similar experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I started doing it, you know, I did these dream comics, and then I kind of got known as, oh, he's the guy who does these dreams, and I really thought this is only one area that I'm interested in. I'm actually interested in doing sort of the gamut of autobiographical, like waking and sleeping consciousness. So I was saying, I want to tell some of my own stories, what actually happened, and it's definitely, you know, sort of, there's like a conversation that goes on in comics, like so-and-so does this kind of story, and then you mentioned Chester, and then so-and-so is going to do this, and so you're kind of talking to each other and talking to the culture at large, and so I was thinking, you know, I do want to do like my own, you know, sexual history kind of comic too, and what should I include, and I think the idea with that strip was it was almost like can you get at someone's sexual history if you just include the sex? And in some ways, the answer is no. Like, I think the strip is kind of about empty, bad sex. And it's, you know, it's sort of about the gaps in between what's actually happening.
It seems more about heartbreak than the sex, even though the sex is the predominant feature.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of about being lost and, you know, just looking for affection or comfort. Or it's just about that whole period that I think a lot of people do go through, where you're flailing around just trying to connect with somebody, and it's just kind of awkward and bad a lot of the time. Yeah.
When you write these sort of strips, do you think about an audience or who might read it? Do you have to put that out of your mind?
I probably do have some ideal audience in my head when I'm writing it. It's not really conscious, but like that strip, I actually was thinking more about a female audience. I know it sounds funny, but I was almost wanting to like explain to women, you know, what men are going through or what it looks like from the other side. And just like I would, you know, I'd love to read a woman's version of that too, like what's going on in their head during this period where people are just kind of passing each other and not connecting. Yeah. And I guess I definitely think of like certain cartoonists, like what will they think when they see it? I do try and put those voices out of my head, but sometimes that's actually a good motivating force too. You kind of, you know, you want to live up to a certain standard, or you want to, you know, communicate to a certain person, you know. So that goes through my head too.
Well, I was also thinking about, you know, the people involved in your past, and not to mention the wife and kids.
Yeah. Well, my kids are too young. My daughter's 3 and my son's 1. They won't see anything till they're 18. Yeah, right.
Stay out of the top shelf, kids.
That's a whole other ball of wax, like what I'm going to do about showing them stuff. I think it's probably fine. I don't think they're going to want to see it, you know, until they're much older. But, like, at my age now, if my dad had something like this, I would absolutely want to read it. I mean, I'm fascinated. So I think down the road they might be interested. But, yeah, my wife kind of has veto power over certain things. Like, she's a good gauge of, you know, what I should be including. And just because she's a good writer, too. She's a poet, and she has a sense for what feels true. But also, you know, that was a very clear boundary. She said, you know, I don't want to see any like bedroom stuff between us in this strip, and so I had to find a creative way to like not include her. And once she kind of set that rule, it actually informed kind of what the strip was about anyway. It was like, oh, okay, well, this isn't about my relationship with my wife, this is really about every other relationship. And
just what brought you to your wife?
Yeah, the kind of grasping that I went through before meeting her
and in between meeting her.
Yeah, right, before I settled down with her, I should say.
Now, the style in that is, I find, completely different from your dream stuff. It's like more of a rougher thing. Is that a purposeful technique to kind of...
Yeah. With that strip, I did all the breakdowns on a separate piece of paper, and then I just took a rapidograph and like kind of followed the general shapes, but drew everything first take without any penciling, and because I wanted it to just be very, you know, immediate and kind of diaristic. And I think that was definitely conscious, and because of that it's become like a whole other way that I draw that's now like available to me. It's become like almost a, you know, a different tool to be able to use. I feel like I kind of have 3 different styles that I use. Like, one is that diary style, and one is more like, you know, ink and brush cartoony style, and then one is painted, which is sort of in between the two.
That would be like the covers for Deadpan number 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the inside self-portrait.
Yeah.
Now, the sexual history and the father, those are your 2 main pieces of autobio stuff?
Well, like I said, the book from Pantheon is going to collect all of it, and it's basically kind of an expansion of Deadpan 2, so it has a whole bunch of dreams. It's kind of broken up. There's like a sexual dream section, and then it goes into the sex history. Then there's kind of a racist dream section, and then it goes into a strip I'm working on now called Black History, and that's sort of like a cataloging of all the black people I grew up with and meditation on race and racism. And then there's sort of like family dreams about my dad, and there's a portrait of my dad, and then I have a portrait of my mom now that I just finished, and there's a family history strip that's kind of the glue at the back of the book that tells, it's sort of the same format as the sex history, but it tells like several generations back in each side of my family. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's the whole book. It'll be a, people will get kind of what I'm trying to do once they see it all together, I think. People have just seen like little dribs and drabs of what my output has been.
And I looked at your blog and obviously checked it out and stuff, and it's just a little bit too small for me to be able to read some of those drips.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to... part of it is the publisher. Like, I don't really want to release things before they're published. But for a while, I was posting them on my blog as I was finishing stuff, and I felt comfortable with that, but I think they want me to save it, which makes sense.
Oh, totally. They have to have a product to sell.
Yeah.
When do you expect the book to be released? The optimum expectation?
Yeah, it's planned for fall 08.
So oh, okay.
A year from now, it should be out.
And we look forward to it. I had a question of mine. I totally like Zomper. I'm going to play a quick song, another quick song,
okay,
so I can get myself back into tune. What would you like to hear? We got Intervention or Men Go Extinct?
How about Men Go Extinct?
Men Go Extinct. Sounds good. We will return with Mr. David Heatley on Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM.
Men are the hunters and gatherers that drag women back to their caves, putting rubber disc glove shackles around their wrists, turning them into the kitchen slaves. But what power do these men really possess? I think it's pretty superficial, we all must confess. So put down your signs and stop protesting, 'cause the men die off and the women keep going on.
Men are expendable and inconsequential,
and the men fall down while the women keep trudging along.
Don't bother bringing your flowers to the graveyard.
The men go extinct just according to their fate, and the women meet women and begin to procreate, and the men sit around trying to figure out just exactly what went wrong.
What went wrong?
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 See, women get trapped in these relationships by men who fall asleep at the wheel. If the men seem bored and disinterested, just imagine how those women must feel. Life becomes nothing but a constant yawn, but one day those men are gonna be fertilizer for the lawn. In fact, that day just might be sooner than we all think. And the men die off, and the women keep going on.
Men are expendable and inconsequential,
and the men fall down while the women keep trudging along.
Don't bother bringing your flowers to the graveyard.
Men go extinct just according to their fate, and the women meet women and begin to procreate, and the men sit around scratching their heads trying to figure out just exactly
what went wrong.
What went wrong?
What went wrong?
What went wrong?
What went wrong?
Does anyone around here know what went wrong?
CITR 101.9 FM. That was Men Go Extinct from our guest today, Mr. David Heatley. I'm just going to quickly do an update of what's happening in the Ink Studs for the next month. Next week, our guests will be Chris Staros and Brett Warnock from Top Shelf Books. Week after that will be Nick Abizdaz. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. He wrote Leica from First Second Books. On the 11th will be Rod Philbrandt, local Vancouver guy, Dry Shave. That's his trip for the Georgia Strait.
Yeah.
And then October 18th, someone we were talking about earlier, Mr. Chris Ware and Jeet here will be joining us to discuss Gasoline Alley.
So cool.
It's going to be a good month.
Can I plug something?
Go ahead, Colin.
The Pirate Show. The second opening of The Pirate Show happens tonight at the Gem Gallery, including a whole raft of lowbrow artists, illustrators, and cartoonists. I saw the first opening at Pat's Pub, but it's well worth checking out.
Gem Gallery is a good art gallery, and they will be hosting the Ink Studs Art Show in January.
Oh, yes.
Of which I picked up the first two pieces last night, or yesterday, from Mr. Mark Bell. Yay! So, How are you doing, David?
Great.
Didn't wash you out with all that useless information of Inkstud's banter?
No, not at all. Mark Bell fan.
Oh, he's quite, his stuff is gorgeous. I'm very happy that he luckily doesn't live too far from where I live, and was nice enough to loan a couple of pieces for art show. So
nice. I'm staring at my original Shrimpy and Paul dolls. I think they're one of a kind, the only ones in the world.
Really?
Someone like sewed them together out of cloth, and I bought them from the Big Island when I was visiting.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic, yeah.
I think, you know what? I just got off him. Is a cover of something that has dolls, a laser copy print of the dolls.
I think I own those dolls.
So there we go. I have the cover from an old Mojo Action Plan, and you've got the actual dolls. So
yeah,
it's a small world after all.
I couldn't help bragging about that. I'm sorry.
That's pretty awesome. And that's Mark's stuff is gorgeous, and his stuff's getting better and better. Each of his newer pieces, his stuff in Kramer's Ergot is.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you are a regular contributor to Kramer's Ergot.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Old Sammy.
You've been in 4, 5, and 6? I can't remember if you were in 6.
I wasn't in 6.
Okay.
I'll be in the next one, though.
The massive tome?
Yeah, the gigantic oversized thing.
What kind of story do you have planned for your 3 pages?
I did this strip, which is kind of like a... It's similar to Overpeck in terms of... It's kind of like a fever dream, and it's basically... like a race war set in the South, and there are these, it's really hard to describe actually, but there's these twin girls, and then there's an older sister who kind of has a relationship with a black boy, and you know, there are these like Black Panther types who kind of scale the wall and try and kill everybody, and there's a giant slave figure in the middle of it. It's very bizarre. It just that kind of all came to me at once, so... I think people will probably be offended by it, and that's okay.
Save.
You don't spend much time in a comfortable place, do you?
Yeah. I try and calm myself down, but yeah, where my mind goes is usually off the beaten trail.
Was your dad a war gamer?
War gamer?
Yeah, I saw there was a strip where he had a board game out.
Oh, like Risk and things like that.
Oh, is it Risk?
Oh.
No, I think actually that one was called War, yeah.
So Colin is a avid war gamer. He has these massive, massive collection of little figurines that he carefully, painstakingly paints with a magnifying glass to get the right color of yellow on the shoulders of the Turkish army of 1912 and...
I don't use a magnifying glass.
Yes, you do. I've seen the magnifying glass.
But I don't use it for painting figures.
Okay.
I don't think my dad would be into that. He's more into, like, the plastic pieces that, you know, symbolize the army. He doesn't actually want to see that people are getting killed. He just thinks, like, in terms of abstract, you know, conquering countries, he'd be really squeamish about the actual soldiers. Yeah, he's kind of strange in that way.
He sounds pretty fascinating with his history of employment.
Yeah. Yeah, my poor dad.
He's a versatile guy.
He's like got a really elaborate internal world, but he's got a very small shell, or he's got a very small physical world. So he's an interesting case. I think he's the reason I'm interested in all these outsider artists and people who have these like elaborate, you know, religious beliefs but live in squalor and things like that. He's kind of like one of those types to me. Yeah.
So you're talking like outside art, so you're talking like the like what kind of stuff, like, because we're talking about comic artists but now outsider artists.
I love Henry Darger, you know, he's kind of the main one, but yeah, I don't know if I can rattle off the top of my head.
Don't worry about it. Now, one of the things you have, and there's been little snippets here and there, are, I guess, models you created based on your characters.
Mm-hmm.
What are those made out of, and what's the plan with those?
Yeah, I started by making some, like, little painted wooden toys, like, for my wife for presents, and then I expanded and kind of made this diorama set of... you know, taking one of the dreams actually from Deadpan 1 and just making a full little action figure set out of it, but just little crude painted wooden figures and trees and things like that. And you know, I haven't really, if I had a show and if I had space and someone wanted me to finish, I would do like a full kind of elaborate world of all the different dreams and, you know, all the different figures kind of interacting. But yeah, that would be the dream down the road. Like maybe when my book comes out, do some kind of gallery show and show the original pages and also show these little diorama sets.
Have you seen photos of Seth's town?
Oh yeah, I've seen the real thing. Yeah.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
The he's making a whole universe around it in comic storytelling too, so it's interesting.
Yeah, he and Chris, I think they're probably part of the reason why I got the idea, definitely.
Well, I guess, yeah, Chris Weirdall's little self-fabricated creations.
He's like making a whole model of the school from Rusty Brown in his basement.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how far along it is. I assume it's like pretty close to being done. I got to see it. It was just mind-blowing. So, yeah, that was an influence, definitely.
Do these guys ever stop?
Yeah, no, Chris's like hobbies where he unwinds are just more work. Like he's got time on his hands. I think I'll do an entire journal about ragtime. That's kind of the way I'll unwind this weekend. Like I don't get it.
I like a nice bottle of scotch personally.
Yeah.
Now, for the Houghton Mifflin, did I pronounce it part right? I can't remember.
It's Houghton, but whatever.
Houghton, there we go.
Sounds like a lawyer's firm.
It does. Well, they actually normally do textbooks.
Ah.
Yeah. But the last year they had the Harvey P. Carr anthology, the Best American Comics 2005, and then this one's the 2006. Are you going to have any pieces?
Last year was 2006, this is 2007. But
oh, okay, but I thought anyway. Is it the best of 2007?
What's that?
Is it the best of 2007, like up till July or something? Is that how they do it?
No, it's just called 2007, but it's actually last year's.
Yeah. Okay.
Whatever. Just so we don't confuse the listeners that they don't buy the Harvey P. Carr one by accident.
But there's some good stuff in that one, too.
No, that one's good. I'm just saying.
Look for the David Heatley cover. Do you have anything on the inside of that?
Yeah, there's some dreams in that were published in MoM. But yeah, I feel like my main contribution is just the cover and I did this dust jacket that folds out that's two-sided, and then the case wrap of the actual book, too, and the three pieces kind of all relate to each other. So that was like almost its own story for the book, I thought.
A little story in itself.
Yeah.
And then for the McSweeney's collection, you did something for the table of contents.
Uh-huh.
As well. Was that specific piece for the McSweeney's? I think book 13.
That was actually also a present for my wife that I don't know how Chris saw it, but he asked me if he could publish it, and I said sure. So I wasn't really going to publish it, but yeah, it was like a Christmas gift for her, celebrating like living together for whatever it was, 6 years. The ups and downs.
Oh, I was just wondering what medium you work in usually.
Yeah, it's mostly ink and brush or rapidograph. I guess I shouldn't say mostly. It's ink and brush, rapidograph, and gouache paint. Those are kind of my three. But mostly, lately I've been coloring mostly on the computer with like little areas of painted color. I don't do like entire pages of color painting anymore.
Well, that was something I noticed is that on the, I think the Comic Art Collective where you have your originals, is you have like the overlay, the transparency overlay of the color stuff.
Yeah, that's for a while I was making, you know, a full black and white original, and then I was like making a blue line and painting that so there'd be these two originals, and ultimately, I just wound up doing so much work in the computer to color correct it and, you know, to get it lined up that it just wasn't worth it. So if I really want a painted area, I'll just kind of paint that one square or that one little section and lay that in. But otherwise, I try and do computer coloring.
Well, everyone's doing the computer coloring, I think, now, so.
Yeah, what's nice is, like, it's a way of, like, dialoguing directly with the printer and choosing exactly what you want. I mean, just a way of having creative control over the printing process as well as the drawing process, you know.
Well, I think Chris got Ivan into computer coloring.
Chris, I think he got everyone into it. Yeah.
Ivan was like totally not wanting to even touch computers, and then Chris showed him all the stuff he could do. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in the same boat, actually. Chris kind of walked me through his tutorial, and I was sold.
Just have a little workshop.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your music. We've got probably about 6 minutes left, and like I said, we had the Velvet Cactus Society.
Yeah.
So, what was that like? What was it? And, you know, people...
Yeah, it was my high school band, actually, and I had my best friend in high school was this guy, Kyle Lapidus, and we basically just kind of, you know, smoked pot and wrote stoner poetry and recorded this stuff on a four-track, and our favorite record label at the time was this label called Shimmy Disc, and so we managed to get it to them and get them to do a CD with us, and we did two CDs with them, and then once I went to Oberlin, we kind of broke up, and I spent probably like 3 years at Oberlin and then in Brooklyn just recording on my four-track. I probably recorded like 100 different songs and just never really did anything with them. I just had the tapes sitting around, and I would listen to them, and I'd make tapes for friends, and, you know, occasionally I played a couple of shows, but mostly just kind of gave up on it once I moved to Brooklyn, and then especially once I got to art school, I didn't write any songs. And it's really just in the last few years that I've kind of been rediscovering these tapes. They've kind of sat dormant for about 10 years now, and I just see them as like a really vivid record of my time, you know, as a teenager and early 20s, just like the emotions and the angst and the anger, and, you know, it's like a real potent source for me, and I'm kind of proud of myself, you know, for putting it out there in the way I did. It's the same, it comes from the same place where my comics come from, I think. It's really raw and emotional and, you know, yeah. Go on.
I guess that's something important to you then, is like kind of keeping a documentation of the different parts of your life and the different times in your life.
Yeah, it's this funny thing where I feel like it's incredibly narcissistic but also like generous at the same time, which I think a lot of my favorite artists are. It's, you know, I just think what's going on in my brain is like the most interesting thing in the world at any given time, and that's a liability, but I guess it's also an asset because I'm able to look pretty deeply and see and then share from that like deeper perspective. And it's a liability because I need to, you know, one of the things I work on is just trying to be like more available to other people and not in my shell all the time. And I don't want to live in that place. I can visit there and then come out and, you know, actually be present with other people. That's what I try and do. Yeah.
Couple more questions. One quick one is, being a father now, has it changed how you've approached your comics?
Yeah, I think it has. It's changed my entire life, so I'm sure it's changed my comics. I think having children, like, has just made me, like, a deeply moral person, you know, and I don't think I had much of a sense of morality in my teen years, and I just really sort of believe in being good and trying to do the most good, and it's like a newfound thing for me, and it's definitely a result of having kids.
I think we're pretty much out of time. The next show guys are waltzing up now.
Uh-huh.
Would you like me to end with Intervention, or would you like me to play one of the songs off the
Intervention would be great. That's okay. My most recent song.
Okay, well, thank you for taking the time to chat with us, David.
This was such a treat. Thank you.
Awesome. And I guess the next thing people can check out is whenever that Kramer's comes out.
Yep. And, yeah, and the Best American should be out next month.
And also, Moam, you'll still be having Dream Strips in there.
Yeah, maybe one more time.
One more time?
Yeah. After that, I'm gone.
Off to the big leagues.
I wouldn't put it that way, but yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing more work.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
That was David Heatley, author of Deadpan, author, writer, cartoonist, and musician. As we're about to find out, we played three tracks by him already, Suburban White Girls, I Hate Your Movies, and Men Go Extinct. The next song we're going to play is Intervention. This has been the Ink Studs Radio Show Fun Hour. This is Robin saying goodbye.
Bye.
That's Colin saying goodbye. Colin's got the sniffles. everyone give him good vibes to get healthy again. I was sick on the weekend, and I was supposed to do an interview on Wednesday, but I postponed it by a week. So we're doing it this week. We originally had the Brian Dalla one booked for the 19th, Colin.
Oh.
But I was too sick. So I'm still not 100% yet. But I got to go to work now. Enough of my whining. People don't listen to the show to listen to me whine. They want to listen to me talk to cartoonists. Well, not even listen to me. They want to listen to the cartoonist. So thank you all for listening. Next week, like I said before, Chris Darrow, Brett Warnock. And then any of you that are going to be at Stumptown, come by and say hi to me. I'll be around somewhere. Chances are maybe hanging out at Robin Bougie's table because he has comics there, but he won't be there.
And hopefully there'll also be word on the street on the 30th of this month with, of course, the cartoonists and other not family-friendly people in the basement at Word Under the Street, where I'll be with my table and a host of other local cartoonists. That's assuming everything goes off smoothly, considering there's still a strike on. But they assure us, the Word on the Street people assure us that there will be a Word on the Street, and everything is going to work out fine.
By that, he means that the union has agreed to let the Word on the Street happen. So you won't be crossing picket lines, because I wouldn't cross a picket line. I'm a proud union member. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Yeah, Crime and Street is up next. Woo-hoo!
With your bedroom, pissing and moaning to the unchained. Your walls are trapped, your roommates and fathers with their knees in vain. Can't get a break, you stupid lies. Shit I love, you're just a squirrel in this white man's world. Trying to get enough.
You need some intervention. You need some intervention. You need some intervention. You need some intervention.
We eat french fries and burgers and cokes until we're warming our knees. Spread a cut to back, chips in the fall, and our hummus and cheese. We talk back, die with the fellas and nukes until we find it. We're living in a mess, no one wants to clean up. We should get stuck on mommy's tin.
We need some intervention. We need some intervention. We need some intervention. We need some intervention.
Better than anyone else, what did you do with their life? I'm talking to anyone for more than 3 minutes, including my wife. God's got a plan, and if it doesn't work out, I'll take a scream and curse. I'm just a worthless piece of trash in the center of the known universe.
I need some intervention. I need some intervention.